Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Tonight we're very pleased to welcome the Kitchen Table Writing Group, led by Ann Randolph. Randolph is the creator of Kitchen Table Writing, which inspires authors to find their authentic voice. She's received grants from the National Endowment for the Arts, worked in London, Italy, and Amsterdam, and has been the director of two opera companies and the Colorado Symphony. Tonight she joins us, as well as many other authors, to share with us the brand new book, Stories Gathered in the Kitchen Table. Please join me in welcoming Ann Randolph.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be at the Tattered Cover. We actually feel like grown-ups because we get to actually be at this great bookstore. And our book, Story Gathered at the Kitchen Table, is a collection of writing from these illustrious writers who are part of our group, Kitchen Table Writing. They come together once a week. Some people have been doing this for over 4 or 5 years. And several of our writers have actually put together books because they come every week and they write at Kitchen Table Writing. So we're going to read a little bit out of our book. Some is new material that people are reading, just to give you a flavor of the kind of writing that we do. These are going to be available. You'll take a book. We'll do some signing after if you're interested, and you'll go upstairs and you'll pay for the book. So this is our readings from Stories Gathered at the Kitchen Table. Beginning our book for Kitchen Table Writing, I want to introduce Megan Evans. Megan designed the cover of this book. Isn't it gorgeous? She did a wonderful job of capturing the whole essence of our book and of our stories. So we're going to begin with a reading by Megan Evans.
Underwater. I am in water up to my throat. The river rushes out and away from the light. Incessant noise bellows down from the waterfall near me. My hands are wet, my body submerged. But I'm holding my clipboard up. I'm holding my pen out of the water. I may drown, but I'm determined my words will not. In every rush of wave, I inhale a gulp of silty drink, but the next moment is a welcome calm, and I write the next word. I'm thankful for the ballpoint pen, thankful for the movement of my hand and a conscious brain. Again, the river flows and induces its rushing, and again, I am sunk. I cough and I spew. I raise my head. I gasp for air. I am again saved by a lull in the current, and I lift my pen and paper again, and I write the next word. Over and over for hours this goes. I'm losing footing. Strength dwindles. The constant water tires my eyes, heavies my head. Again, a breath is allowed, and I see a flash of the sunlight. I see glorious birds flying above. Holding my breath, I've had a full minute to think of the next word. And I take a moment, and I write it. And again, I become engulfed in the burial of water. My wet hair, a soaked tangle of tendrils, covers my face and then enters my mouth. I spit it out. Will I make it? I wonder. Will I get to dry ground in order for my words to find their resting place? I don't want them to wash away. So I will keep writing word after word if it drowns me. I will put pen to paper between the gasps and the spurts, and I will suck in the air that is given me as if it is my last, and I will keep writing. Thank you.
That really captures what we do. We are about putting the page filled with words. So thank you for doing that. We love to know who's here, and I'm sending around a clipboard, and if you would put your name and even your email on that, it is a lot of fun for us to know who's attending. So a clipboard is going around as well. I want to introduce Alice Barodkin. Alice was a former, and still is a former, Colorado State Representative. And I call Alice the driver. She said, well, wouldn't it be interesting for us to put together a book? And she drove us, and we did. Then she said, wouldn't it be fun for us to go out and do readings? And she drove us, and here we are. So Alice Barodkin, who has her own new book that is about to come out. Alice.
It really was just a suggestion. Actually, I'm going to be reading from a book, my book, soon to be published, and it's called Caught Between the Bettys. It's dedicated to Betty Crocker and to Betty Friedan. I come from a generation of divas. Back in the 1940s and the 50s, divas were classy women. They were perhaps a little bit full of themselves. They wore glamorous dresses. If their hair was piled high on their heads, and sometimes they would fashion it into a chignon held in place with tortoiseshell hairpins. Their nails and their lips were often painted bright red. They never went anywhere without gloves. Most did not go to college. Who needed college back then? Your job was to find a man. Divas are part and parcel of the times that I grew up in. I grew up during World War II, and I remember blackouts and rationing and men and women in uniform and Rosie the Riveter, war bond rallies, and what seemed to a young girl to be the excitement of a world at war. In those days, men and women were expected to adhere to certain roles. The men had theirs as the proud protectors and providers of their families, and the wives and the women had theirs as housewives and mothers who relied solely on their men as breadwinners. Both played their parts very well, if only on the surface. When I married in the 1950s, I tried to follow all the rules. Make your man happy, keep your house clean, and prepare wonderful meals a la Betty Crocker. What I never counted on was the other Betty coming along, Betty Friedan. With her publication of The Feminine Mystique, I was now caught between the Bettys. Thanks to Betty Friedan, I realized that I wanted to do more with my life and be validated for who I was and what I was doing. I didn't know I was bucking the system, but as I think about it now, I sure was. Betty Friedan was one of the first feminists to write about the problem without a name. We were the ones who questioned the difference between ironing your husband's shorts and what happened to my college degree. This is my memoir, with a few revelations for those of us in my era, and it is also a history lesson and a cautionary tale for the next generation. I like to say that I wrote this memoir because I took a nap when I was 12, and when I woke up, I was 80.
And we thank you for driving us. We appreciate that. Shirley Ann Dormish has told me that she really, really loves to do these readings. It's one of her very, very favorite things. And Shirley Ann is a mother of 5 and a grandmother of 12. This particular reading she's doing is an alphabet piece, which means that every sentence starts with a different letter of the alphabet. So as she reads, you might see if you can follow the alphabet with her. So Shirley Ann Dormish, thank you.
Sisters, A to Z. After the shoe dropped with Patty's diagnosis, a new phase began. Battles were constant. Crying was common. Distress was prevalent. Each day flowed into the next with no answer. Fog permeated our thinking. Guessing was our game. Hindered by distance, the phone became our tool. Investigation into this disease was the goal. Just when we thought all was beginning to come together, another roadblock occurred. Kin failed to communicate. Listening to the adult children was sad. Mom, not mom any longer. Needless to say, from afar, we tried to help. Over and over, we had to stand back and wait. Problems kept presenting themselves without a resolution. Quietly, I suggested a bracelet for her safety, but no response was forthcoming. Results of the test confirmed our thoughts. Sadly, we conversed about what the doctor said. Thoughts and memories flooded through our minds of wonderful and great times together. "Uncle, Uncle," we shouted, "don't take our sister." Visiting in February was a great yet sad opportunity to be together, just in case. Wahoo! Patty was able to shoot 3 baskets, one after another, while her grandchildren watched. Xeric times are coming. However, Xanadu waits. Yeast of this disease grows uncontrolled. Zig, zag, zero, zap. This is Alzheimer's.
Peggy Dillon Jackson is a designer, and she's putting together a book about mystic fairies, and is a wonderful, wonderful artist that is illustrating some of her fairy works. So, Peggy.
Fascinating mom. She deserves to be a queen or a goddess. She believes I am both. And a fairy and an angel, too. I believe in women, in she. I believe each of us, gender differences aside, has the seed of something bigger than we can imagine. Larger than titles or wealth or the greatest material treasure to be found. We are that of which belongs to the infinite. The ether. My mother just thanked me for being a fascinating person. My mother, who is on her way to being ancient, it took over 80 years to slow her forces down. My mother, who's a magician, an artistic marvel, storyteller, chef, loving nurse, keeper of Quack Quack the Duck, Baron von Blakely Dillon III, and little Stevie with the beautiful, with his thick lenses that make his eyes extra big and blue, to help those who know him to see so much clearer. My mother, who traveled with me around the world, the person who knows me better than anyone else, and serves me plates of gratitude for what she sees. You have always worked hard. You have done your best for yourself and anyone else on your path. You are a grand hero, Mom, including your ability to see your weaknesses and speak them out loud for me to hear. We have had so much. So many incredible adventures together in this life. Writing this to you has lifted my soul. I will write the stories down and do my best to keep this adventure going. Infinities of love to you, beautiful girl, from your number one.
What a wonderful tribute to a mom. And Isabel is Peggy's daughter, who is, by the way, passing around. Some of you are asking, what is this this bag for? And we're giving away some door prizes at the end. And so that's what the bag is for. I want to introduce Cynthia Aschenbrenner. Cynthia actually works nights, so this is daytime for her. And Cynthia has a wonderful book, a children's book called The Egg Book. Cynthia.
The present, the now, so difficult to be present in the moment. Not so for the cat, who must look for opportunities now for the chance to leap across the floor and catch the only thing moving in the apartment. Me. He must be prepared in every new moment for a clean and accurate leap. I learn a lot from the cat. How he stays ready in top form to land on his feet, and how he creates opportunities to practice. He understands my routine and lies in wait when I get up in the morning. I come around the corner, and he pounces. If his aim is just a little bit off, he might hit my knee with his hard little head and fall to the ground. He stays undaunted. He has to make a split-second decision to attack again or pretend that he is cool and in control, or turn, take cover, and prepare for a new attack from a different vantage point. He darts off to take cover behind the round blue exercise ball. As I approach, he shifts his position, first to the left, then to the right, continuously adjusting for which direction would be the best to catch me from. I make a sudden move towards him and shuffling my feet loudly. He dives behind a shallow box. About 6 feet away, he pulls himself into pounce position, his ears up, his body low over his spring-like legs. I move. He quivers. His ears go down, and the rest springs towards me. Because success is now.
Catherine Carroll wears many hats. And Catherine actually has the honor of being on the Governor's Council for working with people with disabilities. Catherine is a great traveler, and hopefully she's going to take us somewhere. Catherine.
You bring out the Tobago in me. Tucked in the shadow of South America lies an island with a small curved beach where colorful glass-bottom boats bob like toys on an aqua sea. There, under the hot, steamy sun, I met Samuel, a young West Indian man whose hair twisted in wild thick ropes and was bleached to a soft shade of ginger. He knelt down beside my beach chair as I nestled in under a bright red umbrella. His eyes smoldered. His brown skin glistened as he reached for my hand, saying it would be mystical. Startled, my cheeks flushed and grew warm. I erupted into a full-body laughter. As if by reflex, I replied, "Oh, man, you are much too young for me." Somehow, in rebuffing him, I found the Tobago in me and slipped into the native tongue. Samuel eased into my life one lazy day at a time. By the third day of my visit, he was my island guide. Together, we rented a little jeep, perfect for traveling meandering narrow roads, driving on what to me looked like the wrong side of the street. Like a song, his words lingered and rested easy on my mind. Each syllable spoke to me as it caressed, like drops of heaven cascading down a waterfall, as we hiked on wet, dark trails in the middle of the rainforest. As we lunched at Gemma's Treehouse Restaurant, his smooth, husky voice became a melody of words. They enchanted me as we drank sweet water straight from fresh-cut coconuts at the roadside stand. The island roads twisted and turned as we drove. The minutes fell into hours as we watched the sun dive into the dark waters of the night as the sea rolled in. I could smell the sweetness of barbecue floating on the sound of steel drums. As we walked the beach, he reached for me, and I walked away. Then I walked right into his heart. As his heart opened, so did mine. Armor, once invisible and charged with defending my tenderness, began to slowly fall away. I could hear the quiet thud as the pieces landed in the cool sand stretching out under Orion's belt, sitting low in the southern sky. Was it the carob beer that I had grown so fond of? Was it the sultry crab and dumplings, the fresh, mellow Callaloo soup? Perhaps it was the spicy roti. Or was it the sound of the steel drums rolling over the ocean's waves that brought out the West Indian in me? A young island man had made me feel more like a woman than I knew possible. My mind held on to the visions of dancing in the quiet island lanes under the swaying palm trees, past grassy fields where goats were tethered and chickens ran free. Just with him, I felt the glide of the red kayak we paddled as we hopped from island bar to island bar, just with him. He wrapped me up in his brown skin as we parted. I was sure our paths would never cross again. The key turned in the lock of my downtown Denver condo. I opened the door, dropped my bags to greet the cat. As she purred, the phone rang. It was him. "Come back to me. Come back to my paradise. Come back to my arms," he pleaded. "You bring out the Tobago in me."
Sort of nice to take some trips when we hear people reading here. Yeah, and for another side of relationships, Jean Caggiano has spent a number of years as an army wife and traveled around the world. So let's hear Jean Caggiano.
The Blue Plates. As she walked into the kitchen, she wondered if he'd still be there. Had he fled? Or would he still be there, seething from the sting of her words? No, he'd fled, but three broken dishes, her favorite blue pottery dishes, lay smashed in a rubbled heap on the floor. Sinking to her knees beside the bruised rubble of her prized dinner dishes, she wept uncontrollably. How dare he break, shatter what he knew was so precious to her, the dishes she'd found in a tiny German shop in Memmelsdorf. She'd so wanted him to come home and sweep her up in his arms, but so often he'd enter the house abruptly, too exhausted even to hug his son and daughter. His only response so often had been to criticize, "What's that toy car doing in the middle of the room again, Joseph?" he'd bellow at her three-year-old son. "I'm sorry, Dad," Joseph would almost whisper, scurrying across the room to pick up his favorite toy. Her insides would churn, and she'd feel the sharp intake of her breath as she felt Joseph shrink into himself, constrict, even as she felt her stomach tie into the all-too-familiar knots. "Just because you're tired from work, don't take it out on him," she yelled one night after Joseph had left the room. Slamming the door behind her, she escaped into the kitchen, loudly banging pots and pans and muttering to herself, "Sure, I'll make your damn dinner. And wait for you to complain. It's too salty, too mushy, too spicy, too bland." Furious, she reached up to take down one of her blue pottery plates and then suddenly thought, "No way, Jose. It's paper plates for you tonight. You don't deserve to eat off my fine china. I'll reserve that pleasure for myself." She was so glad it was all behind them now. The struggle, the turmoil, the pain of those early years and the growth. My God, how amazing that change was possible. She never would have thought it. It's safe now, she thought. We can be ourselves together. And reaching over, she smoothed his snowy white hair, much thinner now. Leaning into the warmth of his body, she kissed his cheek and then padded down the hallway into the kitchen to brew their morning coffee. Carefully, she placed the apple cake she'd made yesterday into the oven so that it would be warm when he awoke, and, reaching up into the cupboard, took down two of her cherished blue pottery plates.
And for our readers, some of the people in the back are reminding me to encourage you all to speak right into the microphone so that they are able to hear in the back. So keep that in mind. I want to introduce Ruth Krebs. And Ruth is a telecommunications executive. I almost got that right. Yeah, great. And Ruth is traveling to 100 countries, and I think she's on about number 78 or something like that, and is just back from one of her trips. And let me introduce Ruth Krebs.
Mary was statuesque, with short blonde hair, porcelain skin, and ruby red lips that matched her perfect manicure. I was her opposite. A brunette then, with a practicality that couldn't compete. After all, she was regal and mysterious, the first classy woman I had ever met who could sit alone at a bar and be content. She emitted a sense of calm and wisdom I envied. She was my friend. One day she informed me that my self-imposed, homebound, single mother duties were over. It was time to break out. We were going dancing. I was nervous and scared, but she assured me it would be fun, and she would teach me her techniques. That first Saturday night at Rupert's nightclub, I wore the only sexy thing I owned, a black and silver dress I had bought once in Macy's in New York. She wore red, as usual, standing even taller in her heels, bold in her gold jewelry. "Follow me and do as I do," she said. I held my head up, walking slowly behind her as we laced through the crowd. I watched the men watch her. She had a magnetism I couldn't imitate. She looked back at me. "We'll go to the bar first." She introduced me to William, the bartender, who tucked our purses behind the bar. We flirted with him while he poured drinks, and I learned we were staking our space for the evening. No one else would sit in our bar stools that night. "Now we'll go fix our lipstick," she said. I was all in, but first she told me her strategy. "We don't buy any more drinks tonight. The men we meet, or William, will take care of that. This journey will get it started. Come with me and watch carefully." She leaned forward, touching William's arm as he handed us our purses. Slowly turning her stool, she stood looking back at me. Her eyes told me to follow. And I did. I wished I could be as sophisticated as her. She never raised her voice. She didn't have to. People would lean in to hear every word. The place was packed, and I had to focus to stay within her reach. Before me was the most phenomenal walk to a restroom I had ever seen. She chose her path carefully, considering the tallest and most good-looking men in the club. As she glided through the crowd, the sea parted. Her hands gently grasped the men's backs and shoulders while she whispered, "Excuse me," in her seductive voice. The men were mesmerized as they clustered around her. I trailed behind, trying her touch approach, feeling like an amateur lapdog. She was so smooth. I was entranced. I wanted men to look at me the way they looked at her, but it seemed an unattainable goal. I felt invisible. Returning to the bar in the same manner, I saw William had replaced our drinks with new ones. From your admirers, Mary. She smiled knowingly as she lightly touched his hand. How do you do that, Mary? I asked. She turned her head and laughed. Her eyes were bright as she looked at me. You can too, Ruth. You can too. And I did. It became our Saturday night ritual. I bought sexy dresses. I learned to stand and talk and touch while walking through a crowd of men. I forgot for a little while I was responsible for a 3-year-old boy. We danced a lot. We met a lot of men. And we would smile at each other, sitting at the bar, our purses safely behind it, new drinks in front of us. And Mary would lean in. They get a package deal with us, you know, blonde and brunette. It would always make us laugh. It still does. And so for all of the aspects of relationships, Melody Jones is going to share with us about a different kind of relationship. Melody is a social media expert, and if you go on Facebook to Ann Randolph Writing Coach, you can see some of her handiwork. Melody Jones.
Mine is a short piece, the shortest one. I'm known for that. It's a poem, The Sun and the Moon. What if the sun were truth and the moon a lie? Daytime glares and bears the gunmetal gray invading hair once luscious with auburn life. Then night soothes her tattered soul as the moon sparks a halo of silver fire, softening a face full of years and smoothing the age snaking across her hands. But too soon, the sun gives stark evidence of the lines and crevices cracking her eyes and making their way around a mouth that whispers history words, her history, of a black-haired boy who walked her in the moonlight and declared her the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen, while moonbeams shone into the nearby pond, reflecting magic and twinkles and the dance of fairies, that the sun can't see, because the sun glares and bares the stagnant water where sharp sticks pierce the surface, and old cups from the fast food place built where the country church used to be are stuck in the reeds and the choking black moss. When night falls, moonbeams blind her to the sun and reclaim her mind. The young girl dreams by the water's edge while moonlight dances and plays, and the fairies rejoice in music, magic and music again. The moon's gentle lies reveal her heart's truth, and she remembers she's beautiful.
I introduce Esther Acosta, and Esther is an international storyteller, and she's going to tell us a story. Esther.
We named our three pigs Dirty Harry, Dirty Mary, and Dirty Larry. Daddy built a sturdy 5-foot wire fence in our backyard to corral our snooty, hairy-faced, fat pigs. They were a spectacle to watch while they wallowed in mud. They were fun to imitate their grunting and entertaining to see how voraciously they gobbled down their food. Late in the summer of 1962 in Retreat Park, Denver, Colorado, Dad was going to make Dirty Harry, Dirty Mary, and Dirty Larry into bacon, pork chops, ham, and best of all, chicharrones, my favorite after-school snack. Mama commanded us kids to stay inside, but my little sister and I snuck outside when we spied Daddy slowly approach Dirty Harry with a sledgehammer perched behind his back. With one huge swoop, Daddy let Harry have it. The hammer bounced off of Dirty Harry like a quarter bounces when you're jumping on a bed. Harry squealed bloody murder and darted away from Daddy, knocking over the wired fence, freeing the startled Dirty Mary and Dirty Larry. The sight of my daddy chasing those three pigs was hilarious. My sister and I, we would be cheering the pigs as they darted away from Daddy's sledgehammer. We'd shout out, "Olé! Aha, piggies! Aha! Olé! Olé!" All of a sudden, our elderly neighbor, Esau Hammonds, appeared at the end of our driveway, carrying a long, very sharp, curved sickle. He had come over to offer Daddy, our neighbor, a hand. The two men jumped into action, chasing, then cornering Dirty Harry into the open-ended garage. My sister and I, unable to see inside, heard several shrilling squeals, then glug, 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 and then stark silence. This went on two more times. I loved coming home from school that fall. Mom would be in the kitchen making tortillas for the evening supper. I would grab a hot tortilla, slather it with butter, open one of the two barrels gifted by our three pigs. I would wrap my tortilla around cubes of scrumptious, meaty chicharrones. As I devoured every savoring morsel, I would remember, and I would give thanks to my daddy, to Esau Hammonds, to Dirty Harry, Dirty Mary, and to Dirty Larry. Thank you.
It makes you hungry, doesn't it? I introduce Marie Picasso. Marie is an energy expert. She can do these absolutely magical and wonderful things that make your life fantastic. Marie Picasso.
Fire blows through me, a fire of ideas and passion, body, mind, and spirit, a fire that wears me out, can blaze so hot and heavy with a smoke that can shield me in all directions. I am hot, and I burn when things get near. All context is lost. I am smothering in my flames. Oxygen is consumed by fire. I have lost my breath. I am panting. I am fight or flight. It is all I see. It is all I am. It drives me. I burn up all around me, then jump the road to the other side, sizzling up the hill, taking all in my path. There are bundles of sooty clouds rising to the heavens, higher and higher. Billows of raw, ash-filled pillows rising and rising. The sparks coalescing one burnt-out tree to another, up and up. No rains come. I continue to burn, my heart expanding with raw rage and bitterness, bringing more destruction around me. Blame, blame, and more blame as each tree falls, as each home of myriad insects, buds, and mammals goes from supple to charred and brittle. Black and more smoke filtering black. Nuts and wood are popping. Seeds are bursting forth, letting new life out of their encasements. Smoke and fire, sparks alight the indigo sky. What are they pointing to? What are they lighting up to see? Colors, orange and gold, purple and green, rise and rise into the air all around me. All life that can move is racing to safety, safety anywhere. Those rooted life forms cannot move and are treaded upon, burnt to charcoal. Altered life forms dropping into the sizzling earth for miles and miles. The fire is in flight, roaring on and on. No barriers can keep it down. Free, boundaryless roars of flame and fire, raging, pushing, terrifying and tremendous, all-encompassing fire. Fire in my head, my heart, my belly, roaring, roaring in mighty, mighty, unencumbered waves of inferno.
I'd like to introduce Ann Randolph, the founder of Kitchen Table Writing, and she's going to read a story that's in our collection. And the title of this story is Laundry. I got home from my wedding trip that featured the Andersonville Civil War prison camp, which should have been a sign. But the biggest sign I created myself. At age 21, a pretty Southern girl, a Miss Alabama contestant, I'd not done one domestic thing in my life. I knew how to sing, toe tap, twirl fire baton, put on a show. But I had no idea how to cook, clean, or conform. I hadn't made meals for myself, let alone for anyone else. So after the wedding trip to the Civil War prison camp, with my new husband, the perfect mate, an up-and-coming attorney with a good Southern name, we returned to early marriage with no training, a week of confused wedded bliss, and a pile of washed dishes stacked in the sink, an overstuffed laundry basket, and a husband who had run out of clean underwear. I loaded the car with laundry bags, a hamper, and a huge box of Tide, and drove to the nearest Swish and Swirl. I'd never been to a laundromat before. I'd only washed clothes downstairs in the dorm, and had even left things there for several days, sometimes a week, and they were always there, a little mildewed, but they were okay. So after the prison wedding trip, I'm at the laundry, waiting on the 9 machines full of clothes to gyrate, rinse, and even dry, while I graded papers for my new job as a teacher of 12th grade boys, all repeaters, all nearly my age. After 4 hours, when the washing was done and the drying was done, I neatly folded undies and put them back in the hamper, put the load in the car, and took our clothes home. I proudly poured clean laundry out over the new double bed for my new husband to see, and before us lay neatly folded lace panties and mauve underwear. All the men's clothes were back at the Swish and Swirl in washer 8, 10, and 3. I drove back to the laundromat at about 10 p.m. Oh, my embarrassed face and my tear-streaked eyes. I went back to find that all the men's underwear were now gone. Not even one pair of boxers, hangers, or white Supermans. My wedding trip to the Andersonville prison camp had bad results. Great. I'd like to introduce Valerie Brinkworth, and Valerie is a pilot, and Valerie has come here all the way from Elizabeth to share her story, and this story is also in our wonderful collection.
Stand back, Orville. Today might be the day. I walk with Dick, my flying instructor, toward my dad's 1946 Rearwin Commonwealth Sky Ranger. It's 6:30 in the morning, October 12th, 1964, Las Vegas, Nevada. I chose Dick for my instructor for reasons obvious to any 19-year-old girl. He was 23, tall, handsome, and the only unmarried instructor at the flight office. Not that I was interested in marriage, because I wasn't. However, I do like good-looking guys. I'm wearing an old blouse, just in case this is the day. It's the custom at Thunderbird Field to cut out the back of the shirt that you solo in, write your name on it, put the date, and hang it on the flight wall. I don't want to ruin a new blouse. We reach the plane and I undo the tie-down ropes. I do a thorough pre-flight before we climb into the cramped cockpit. I go through the checklist and start the engine. Carefully, I taxi down the row of parked airplanes. I don't have a radio, so at the runway, I stop and search the skies for incoming aircraft. My takeoff is flawless, and I land with no bounces. For once, I have a good-natured reputation at the airport of having made more landings per takeoff than anyone else. My takeoff is flawless. I do some touch and goes, good ones. Dick tells me to stop. Good luck, he says, flashing his charming smile as he gets out. Oh, I take a deep breath and I say a short prayer that I can solo safely. I only have 14 hours of flight time. I add the power and pull back on the stick, and the airplane leaps into the air. I go around the pattern three times doing touch and goes. Obviously, I have real pilot potential. I don't want this glorious flight to end, so I go to the practice area and I do that falling leaf maneuver that I can only do while singing, "Hello, Dolly, this is Louis, Dolly." Wait, there's an airplane there and it's getting awfully close. I wonder if that dumb pilot even sees me. I head back to the airport. Pilot in command. Euphorically, I land and taxi back to my parking place. Dick is there waiting for me. How perfect. But he has a look of anger on his face. "What in the hell were you doing?" he shouts as I climb out. "I told you to go around the pattern, and you take off for the mountains. Didn't you see me in that plane trying to get you to turn back? If you don't do what I tell you, I am never going to fly with you again. And I won't sign off your logbook." "You didn't tell me to stay in the pattern. You said, good luck, and walked away. And no, I didn't know that was you flying so close. You are dangerous." Dick and I have been arguing for about what he actually said.
for the 50 years of our marriage. And it isn't settled yet.
Our next reader, Krista Hanley. And Krista has been involved with putting together the art show at the Stock Show. So she has been overworked. So we're glad you're here. Krista is putting together a book about the time that she was a student during the Columbine shootings. And so, Krista Hanley.
The Artist in Residence. He has us stand on a stump outside the art room in front of the red wall. We held each other's wrists, straightened our arms, and leaned out like a pinwheel, balanced. He had come to the school with the red walls out of pity or shock or grief or curiosity, I don't know. But I liked him because before it all changed, he read Zen poetry to us and took us to the mountains to write our own. Then, after, at the school with the red walls, he told us about that Chinese character, the one that means both opportunity and destruction. Or was it opportunity and chaos, or opportunity and tsunami? He told us how the character was made out of both those elements, that without one, there could not be the other. From chaos comes opportunity, he said. But I didn't believe him. Because I felt as if I'd been hit by a tsunami and I was drowning because I couldn't swim in those waters, that flood. I had no more bearings, and I could not breathe anymore. We held wrists and stood on a stump outside in front of the red wall, and he said, "What will happen if you let go?" "We will fall," we said. Duh, we knew the answer. "So let go," he said. So we did, we let go. And we all fell off the stump and stepped down onto the sidewalk. "See," he said, and we looked around. We had missed the point. "You can support each other," he said. We nodded silently. But the problem was, we had already fallen. That's why we were at the school with the red walls.
And to close, Carolyn Finneran is going to read a piece that's also in our book. It is the close of our book. And Carolyn was one of the original merchants at Cherry Creek North. Carolyn invites us to her home on Tuesday mornings, and that's where we write. And we just thank her so much for providing this wonderful artistic environment for us where we can produce this absolutely wonderful work. Carolyn.
Thank you, Anne. It's such an honor to be here and to be with my fellow writers. It's been quite a journey, and we've been doing it for many years now. And it's exciting to be at the Tattered Cover. My piece is The Right to Life, W-R-I-T-E. When I write down what matters to me, I write myself back to life, lost and found in my own writing. I have always written. After I closed my shop in 2000, we started the Tuesday Writing Group. And then I would set the stage. I'd find my favorite pen, my notebook, organize the house, my thoughts, and anticipate the arrival of my writing companions. We'd light a candle. These would be the rituals that would help us get started. I'd make sure that the ambience was perfect, and in my stories, the moss was hanging softly, and there were soft air and soft colors. Then Anne would tell us to stop. And I looked, and nothing had happened in my stories. It was like my life then. Nothing happened. I wanted a bigger story. I wanted names for my characters. And I wanted to meet the grandmothers that I never knew. After my mother died, my brothers put a box aside for me. It was opened only after I had started a family search. There were a few letters. They were from my grandmother Pearl in her own handwriting to my mother Myrtle and my aunt Inez. "Be good, little girl," she admonished them. And then she described driving alone in her Ford from Baton Rouge to Alexandria, Louisiana in 1924. She died in 1928. The 1910 Times-Picayune obituary about Daddy's mother, Joanna, said, "She was 32. She was a beloved wife and left two little boys and many friends who will miss her." I miss her. I missed all my grandmothers. Pearl and Joanna and Ellen Kingston and Maria Juana and Inez and Myrtle and Octavia and Louis-San Marini de Mandeville and Jean Sophie and Clarissa and Hyacinth Amadie de Villiers. Their essence is in me. The Indian princess that I found is rooted in Louisiana history. The Indian slave, the slave owner, the Canary Islander, the grocer on Magazine Street. The facts of their lives, the births and the deaths and the marriages, were really easy to find. Letters they wrote, a piece of lace left, are my treasures. The real mysteries, however, are in the quiet times. They come and they whisper to me. And their stories connect us. I write to find us, and I write to bring us all back to life.
I want to thank all these wonderful readers. So you can tell that there's some moving stories inside this book. And I really want to acknowledge our readers because they have the courage to sit down and write from their heart and write themselves to life. And so we're delighted that you all have come to hear us read. Would any of you like to ask any questions about the writing of our book or any particular questions about the stories in the book? We hope you don't, because we've never done questions before. No. But does anyone have any questions? Oh, I made it not happen. They tell me. Okay, great. Thank you.
What workshops do you have coming up, Anne?
Great. We are now writing 2 days. We write on Tuesday mornings and we write on Wednesday mornings. And that's a pretty regular. We do that almost every week. And then from time to time, we have special workshops. The information about workshops you can find on our website, which is kitchentablewriting.com or annrandolph.com. And if you give me your name and your email, I will send you information about it. Good. Thank you. Thank you for asking that. Any other questions? Okay, Carolyn.
How many books have you got coming out of this group?
That is a great question. Some of you might know Philippe Dunoyer. Philippe Dunoyer was the CEO of Total Petroleum, and he came and he wrote with us for a couple of years every week, and he not only has a book that he's created about being a 9-year-old in France in World War II, but he has produced that book, and he's also produced it in French, which I think is exciting. So that's one book. Alice Barodkin has a new book that's coming out, and you heard a little bit about that. And her wonderful editor is here, Barbara Munson, who has just done this wonderful job of taking all the writing of Alice, which is copious, and helping her direct that into a book. I have a novel that's hopefully coming out in 2016 called The Sweet By and By. It's a Southern Gothic novel. Megan Evans has a book that she's she's working on. She's concentrating now on the writing over a 3-month period, and it's a book about the it's told by a house, but it's a wonderful, wonderful moving story. How many other books? All right, Cynthia has two and one on the way. Jean Caggiano has two that are published, and she's putting together her third book now. And the rest of you, and Krista, there you go, all right, hiding, yeah. Krista is almost finishing her book, and Ruth has gotten all of her stories into, is it 3 notebooks? They're about this thick. Yeah. She has 3 notebooks of all the writing that she has done. And it's a wonderful story about growing up in Minnesota, which if anybody can make it through Minnesota, they can make it through life for sure. Yeah. And we have the fairy book. I mean, so everybody, there's a novel. Valerie Brinkworth is putting together a novel. So everybody is writing their book. Esther Costa, as I told you, is a storyteller, and she's taking her stories that she speaks, and she's working on putting those into a book. So I think, how many books are coming out? Raise your hand. That's everybody sitting there. Yes, yes. So thank you for that good question. Good. Anybody else want to ask a question of me or of one of our readers? Yes, thank you. It's really very mixed. This day and age, it's so difficult to get a publisher because it's so competitive. And so there are some people that are working on books that are with what we call major publishers. A lot of people are self-publishing, and then several of our people are putting together their book, and then they're sending it out to market to see if they can get a publisher for the book. So there are ways. There's a whole new world of bookmaking today where you don't have to wait on some grown-up in New York to say it's okay. You can have ebooks. Catherine Carroll is doing has a blog online, and that blog is developing into a book. So that's where we're coming from. Anybody else want to ask a question? We're going to hang around out here, and if you would like anyone to sign your book, we're delighted to have you. So thank you so much. We appreciate you coming here.
I just want to take this opportunity to thank Anne very much for everything that she's done for us. It was never my intention to write a book, but all that writing and encouragement, and thank you.
Thank you.
Yay.
Thank you so much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.